If you watch the movie Titanic, you might remember that as the great ship is sinking into the North Atlantic Sea, the priest reads Psalm 23. I'm sure that James Cameron, when he was writing that movie, realized that everyone, regardless of how familiar they were with the Christian faith, would know, would appreciate, would recognize this psalm. The Psalm 23 that we often hear read at funerals, that we've maybe memorized as children, that we've heard sung in a variety of ways by people like Bono from U2, or as I was preparing this sermon, a practice of mine is to have WRTI, the FM station, on the computer playing in the background. And sure enough, as I picked up my text to read the Psalm 23, on the radio comes Psalm 23, composed by, I had to look it up, Alexander Zemlinsky, a composer I wasn't familiar with, who wrote the text around 1910 for what he called Psalm 23, Opus 14. Yes, Psalm 23 is everywhere. So how does one preach this very familiar text? It strikes me that this psalm is one that we often read and don't really quite let it sink into us because we're so familiar with it. When we hear the psalm, we often think of shepherds, but we're not really very familiar with shepherds as the readers or listeners to this text would have been in its day. It strikes me that we romanticize shepherds. We talk about shepherds in sort of glorious ways. But these people would have heard shepherds as being ones that were the most lowly of the lowly. So we say maybe the garbage collectors of the day or whatever category you might consider of sort of menial, lowly workers. And the fact that many of the shepherds of that day would have been women, relegated again to those of low class, so probably be more accurate for us to use feminine pronouns when we talk about shepherd. Another significant situation that would have been true in the first century is almost sort of the juxtaposition of the lowly shepherd, and that is that the kings and rulers often referred to themselves as the shepherds of the people. Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel all contrast the divine shepherd with the worthless shepherd kings, as they graphically refer to the kings and those that shepherded them during their time. Ezekiel pulls no punches when he says, and I quote, referring to the kings, "You have not strengthened the weak, healed the sick, bound up the injured, brought back the strayed, sought the lost. They were all scattered because there was no shepherd, and scattered because food and became food for wild animals." From Ezekiel 34, 2 through 5. So in contrast to the failure of the earthly kings, God does what a good shepherd is supposed to do, and that is provide the opportunity for flourishing for the sheep. It's always a temptation, like we heard in the confession, for the people of God throughout history to get their loyalties confused, to worship the empire and the latest expression of that in the shepherds of the day. And these earthly kings, presidents, dictators love that empire worship and even sometimes use language that exalts themselves to that kind of status, to our dismay. I had the rather difficult decision this past week, called a couple weeks ago by our mayor, Jeff Hollenbach, a friend of many of us, and Jeff asked if I would give the invocation at the borough council meeting last Monday evening. I considered it, and mainly because Jeff's a friend of mine and I didn't want to disappoint Jeff, I said yes. But I wrote the prayer very carefully, knowing that there might be some of those borough council members who are not Christian. And then I was struck, and I knew this was coming, but I was struck that as we stood for the prayer and as I finished my prayer, immediately everyone turns around, faces the flag, and recites the Pledge of Allegiance. I stood in respect. Is it possible for us to pledge our allegiance to the flag and say, "The Lord is my shepherd"? Not the president, not any modern leader, but the Lord is our leader, our guide. This text strikes me as one of unrestrained, full confidence in the care and love of the good shepherd. Good, not so much in the moral sense of good as we use that, but good in the sense of wishing to lavish onto us all the good things of life. God is seen in this psalm as steadfast, walking, leading, guiding, keeping us, God, active, resourceful, with us, not off in some distant galaxy. But this shepherd God isn't just a personal friend, but one who watches over the people and provides what is good for them, as any conscientious leader should do. But very quickly, the psalmist turns from statements about God to say something about herself. The Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. Or as many of us learn from the King James Version, I shall not want. I discovered, though, that "I lack nothing" is actually a more precise translation. But I wonder, is there any of us this morning, standing or sitting here, who can honestly say, even in the emotion of the moment, "I don't lack anything"? Some of the best things we do out of our sense that we need something. Maybe that's the reason you're here this morning. You felt like you needed to come to worship, to gather with your friends and fellow believers, those that are seeking to follow Jesus on the way. Or you could have simply said, "Nah, I don't need that." Easier to stay home, perhaps to jump on Zoom or just sleep in this morning. Our country's economy is built upon advertising. Again, that was pointed out in our confession. And what they're seeking to do in advertising is create wants and portray those as needs. You really need this. You lack something. Picture the person who was at a lavish banquet that the chefs and everyone had worked days to prepare, and it was immaculate and beautiful and looking splendid. But you get there and say, "Yeah, I don't need this. I'm not hungry." Or a student who enters the classroom and announces, "I don't need to learn anything. I know everything I need to know. I'll just put on my earphones and listen to music. And the rest of you intellectually needy people can go on with the lesson." And a regular part of our worship liturgy is a time when we share our joys and concerns and pray together. And can you imagine getting up and leaving at some point just before this time when you might say, "No need for me to waste my time in prayer. I don't lack anything. I've got nothing to say to God." Can we regard the psalmist's claim, "I want nothing" or "I lack nothing," to be anything more than exaggeration, a person out of touch, perhaps, with their true situation? I don't know. But then I thought about this in a little bit different way. Mary and I are doing premarital counseling, or just finished premarital counseling with a couple from the Ambler congregation, and because Michelle, one of the pastoral staff there, went to school with one of the people we were counseling, they thought it better for some other people other than their pastors to do the premarital counseling. So we were invited and agreed to that, and it's been a delightful experience with this couple. And we invited them to do a prepare and enrich inventory. And in this inventory, they agree or disagree or strongly disagree with statements around a whole variety of issues related to premarital counseling. That's scored, and then they get the results, we get the results, and then that became the just for the meal of a conversation with them about these things. One of the things that prepare and enrich factors in is a thing that they call idealized distortion. In other words, how much does this couple have stars in their eyes? Unwilling and unable even to see with real eyes what they might be facing. And it's true for any couple. And they expect that. I wonder if there's some idealized distortion going on here with the psalmist. We hear the beloved say of the other beloved, "This person just perfect in my eyes." And we cut that person some slack, saying they're in love. And love is, we sometimes say, blind or distorted. The psalmist, it appears to me, is in love with my shepherd, our shepherd, the Lord. And so it's appropriate, I think, that the psalmist says, "I lack nothing." However, as we move on to the rest of the psalm, there's a sense in which the statement that opens the psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd, I lack for nothing," makes more sense. As we move through the psalm and listen to the psalmist praise the attributes of the shepherd as the one who leads, guides, keeps, protects, and cares, the statement, "I lack for nothing," is put, I think, into a context. There is a growing confidence that God not only knows us, but is willing to walk with us and provide what we need through life, even as we walk through the darkest valleys of our experience. Maybe the psalmist wants to train our senses of need to be more receptive and appreciative of what God provides, even if what is provided is not what we might think we most need. Maybe that which we never lack is not always our heart desire, but is that spark that God puts in us of our desire for God, even when we may not recognize it. We may not accumulate all the stuff that we want in this life, but in the middle of this constant longing and grabbing, it's good to know that we have one who cannot be bought. The love and care of God is the constant that undergirds our lives. We have, the psalmist says, a God who is actively committed to us, not only walks with us, but also provides for us. To say, because the Lord is your shepherd, I want for nothing, could be seen as exuberant declaration of love and relationship. Or as the Book of Common Prayer says of Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, therefore I lack nothing. You may have heard it said that when you have your health, you have everything. Of course, it's exaggeration too. Health is a wonderful thing, and it's in fact when we don't have our health that all kinds of other things diminish and fall away. That when we have good health, we see that as being important. Can this be somewhat of an analogy to the first and opening line of Psalm 23, that when you have the Lord, when we have God as our shepherd, we have the most important thing in our lives? The Lord, the creator of all, the one who holds us, is not just the center of the universe, but the center of our community and of our lives, our shepherd. And as we enter into another election cycle, when we hear the ads and the clamor of the shepherds among us, let's keep this in mind, that our allegiance is to the Lord, who is our shepherd. And I don't see anything in Psalm 23 that claims that those of us who are the sheep of the shepherd are guaranteed a permanent good health or food or shelter or friends and family just because we know the shepherd. And yet they can experience their needs within the context of steadfast love and care. And I think the psalmist opens by saying that it's this reassurance and this confidence that makes all the difference. The rest of the psalm explains why the psalmist is able to claim that because of who the shepherd is and what the shepherd does, we lack nothing. So I plan in a couple of weeks, next Sunday, Jessica Miller will be in the pulpit. But the following week, the first Sunday in May, I plan to come back to this psalm to look more at the second part of the psalm. So maybe in this intermediate time, you may want to just refamiliarize yourself with the psalm. Listen to some of the music that created around the psalm. Read it, ponder it in a variety of translations. Try using feminine imagery. Whatever speaks to you from this rich psalm. Amen.